This is the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Welcome to episode 46 of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast, the most unassuming podcast in the business. My name is James Myers, and I'm your host. Today we're going to be talking about game assumptions and when to break them. With me in the studio tonight are three designers who make no assumptions about their games. First up, Daniel Solis.
Hello, hello.
Next up is Drew Hicks.
Howdy.
And finally, we have Matt Haberfeld.
Hi there.
It's nice to see you guys tonight. So let's talk about, before we begin, what's in the oven? What have you guys been working on? We'll just go around the table. We'll start with you, Drew.
Most of my game design time right now has been going into a tabletop RPG called Demon Hearts, which is based on Digimon, Persona, and other kind of Power of Friendship style battle anime. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Sweet.
All right. Daniel?
Working on things I can't talk about, mainly. But big things coming up are demoing Flying Taxi at PAX, PAX Unplugged and the Unpub Zone. And then after that, Board Game Geek Con.
And PAX Unplugged just announced that they're like doubling the amount of space, so we are going to have a huge Unpub room at PAX Unplugged.
What's in between PAX Prime and what's in between like an Unpub Prime and Unpub Mini? Like that's kind of what's happening at PAX. Unpax.
And Matt, what about you?
So I'm working on Dark Side of the Mind, trying to get it across the finish line. And then in my spare time, of which there is very little, I'm working on a game where you try to build a terrible alibi and other players are trying to ruin your alibi while strengthening their own alibi.
A very interesting card play.
Yes.
Interesting to see it change as it goes through all the iterations.
Yes.
Nice. I've just been cranking along and getting ready for Essen, and it's now 1 month, basically, until Essen, since I lost the weekend before Essen to a wedding. So I have 1 month to get ready, basically.
You kind of lost the weekend last weekend, too.
Yeah, we lost two testing sessions. That's tough. Working.
Yeah. All right, so let's jump into today's main topic, where we're talking about game assumptions. And this all started from a 2013 talk by Rob Davio, talking about his design with Risk Legacy and Seafall, which at the time was a 2014 hopeful release. It was eventually 2017?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. But he was talking, he talked a very good chunk of that was about the assumptions you make designing a game and what happens when you break them, whether it is with the way your pieces interact, with the way your components interact. And so Daniel took that and started a hashtag on Twitter in early 2014. Things kind of blew up from there. There was a lot of good chatter around it. And so we're going to kind of come back to some of those assumptions and talk about them tonight, talk about basically what games broke them and if they're good things to break and that kind of thing.
What happens when they're broken?
Yeah. What happens when you do actually break these assumptions and either they work fantastically or they crash and burn?
All right.
So we're just kind of do a little bit of a round table, talking a little bit of an unusual format for listeners this week. So let's go ahead and get started. We got a big list here. So our first assumption is that in a game, only you move your pawns. So what do you guys think about that one?
Definitely not.
You don't?
You don't move your pawns?
Well, there are definitely games where everybody can move everybody's pawns.
Yeah.
Like the PAX games in particular, like you don't really have any pawns because you don't own the countries. Mm. You manipulate everyone for your own, you know, secret goal or some kind of objective.
Oh, Magic Maze breaks this rule by letting everybody move every pawn, but it's the type of movement that you own rather than the individual pawn itself. So you move left and right or up and down or through portals or what have you, but if you need to get through a hallway that goes up and down and you can only move left and right, you need to rely on your teammate to get you through.
Yeah, that's the example I was thinking of as well for this one was Magic Maze where people have the control over a direction of movement instead. An interesting way that kind of popped into my head that this could be broken is the mechanism of like bumping in a worker placement game. A lot of times in worker placement games, you can knock someone out of a space and move them to somewhere else. Can you guys think of anywhere that player gets a benefit, benefit of where you bump them to?
Oh, yeah. Chimera Station. It's Chimera Station, the theme is that you're these aliens occupying these spaces in Chimera Station to expand the station. and the workers that get placed there may be bumped off if the worker has these claws. You can like modify your workers. Mm-hmm. It's kind of this whole thing. But should your worker be bumped off, they are sent to the workers' lounge. And there at the workers' lounge, whoever goes there, the owner of that worker, I think, gets a coin or a food. And both of those resources are pretty valuable for what they are. Not like game-breaking or anything, but it's a pretty nice compensation for losing your spot on the board.
Yeah, I mean, there's something like that in Diceforge, too, which is not necessarily worker placement. But if somebody goes to the spot you are going, or you're already sitting on, you get bumped out, and you get, I think you get a free roll of your dice or something like that.
I think there have been a couple of worker placement games, too, where or auction, basically, like Amun Re, where if you're outbid on a space, then you get that auction token back to place elsewhere to outbid potentially someone else, or to get a first bid on something that hasn't been bid on yet. And in doing so, you have essentially moved someone else's pawn, but you haven't made the choice there of where that pawn would go to. And I think that that's kind of the unifying thing across all of these is that there's a half step of away from the assumption that I think we're talking about, like where you can remove someone's worker that they've or pawn that they've placed where they've chosen to, but it isn't that you choose where that pawn goes to next. Or you deny your opponent the choice of where that pawn would go to next.
So there is actually one game or one series of games I'm thinking of where it is sort of that situation. A lot of the Academy games in the Birth of America series, so you've got 1775 and 1812, where you are one faction, but you can move any allied faction with you when you move to another space. Oh. And so it's not necessarily that you're moving your opponent, but if you're not exactly able to communicate clearly with your partner, you may move them in a space they don't necessarily want to move to. Because you're like, I need to win this battle now and need your help whether you want to help me or not.
Mm-hmm. Downforce. Downforce totally does that too. That you have control over the race cars and you don't own those race cars. Like, most explicitly do not own those race cars when you're moving them. And I think there's even a power that allows you to move your own race car on someone else's turn, which in any other game would just be the normal default. Like,
yeah.
You always move your own car. That's a great privilege to have in this particular context.
Yes, and the raccoon en route, as we discovered, can bring allies with them and use them as meat shields to fight the enemy. So you can take your quote-unquote allies with you, but they're the ones that die, and you're fine.
That's similar to the Academy Games rule, I guess, where you can move your allies' pieces, and I guess
at least in this one, you are, like, you win or lose as a team, and Root is completely...
Yeah. Sure.
They are your opponent.
But in both of those cases, there's kind of a piece of... correct me if I'm wrong here, there's, like, a piece of metagame information that's expected to be there, like you're going to say to that player, hey, I'm going to take three of your pieces along with me. Although in the Root case, you may do it whether they want to or not, right?
Correct.
So, yeah, that's really cool. All
right, so next assumption. You know which player you are. Or I guess you know which pieces you are in control of? Or there's a bunch of different ways of phrasing that one.
Yeah. The first thing that came to mind, and I don't know if this actually applies, but so if this is like too, like if this isn't where we're going with this, tell me. But I was thinking of Masquerade. And so often roles can move around there. Same thing with One Night Ultimate Werewolf. Roles move around so much that at first you may know what role you've been assigned, but and which team you're on. But by the time that the night has completed, you have no idea. Is that kind of what we're thinking?
I was actually thinking of Masquerade as well. And it's totally embarrassing when you swap a role and make a mistake, and you're like, nope, I am this person, and oh wait, I'm actually not because I made a mistake.
Well, I made that mistake just playing Ku, and I forgot which role I actually had.
I was going to mention Ku, because the way I play Ku, because I'm very bad at it, is I don't look at my cards, and then I just pick the actions that I want, and then someone will call me on it, and then I have to decide whether I'm that person or not.
It's a very dangerous way of playing.
Wow.
Well, it's not any worse than when I look at the cards to tell a really bad lie and get eliminated on the first turn.
Right. That's true. You can more convincingly lie because you don't know him. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally am the Duke.
Surprise, I know.
This is another half step back, but the thing that first came to mind here for me was Battlestar Galactica. You don't know what team you're on. It's the same kind of dynamic that happens in One Night Werewolf, where you have to play kind of hedging your bets towards which objective you want to try to push for. Make sure that neither team's getting particularly close to winning. But that's more like you don't know which team you're on, then you don't know which player you are. For knowing which player you are, the thing that's kind of coming to mind is games like Assassin Con or 15 Minutes to Kill, I think is the name of one of them. They're kind of hidden movement games where you're moving pawns around the board and trying to get some sort of an objective. Could there be like a reverse of that where you know an objective that you have to get for one of the pawns, but you're trying to figure out which pawn it is? And it actually wouldn't be too much of an inversion, because at least in 15 Minutes to Kill, I think that's the name of it, we'll find out, you have an unknown target, I believe. So you're trying to line up where one of the pawns is, but you're not necessarily sure which pawn it is, and you have to deduce from other players' actions which ones aren't yours, basically.
Oh, you know, that's funny, because it's so much more common to have games where you don't know who the other players are.
Yeah.
Like, that we take for granted in, like, Citadels or whatnot, but...
Yeah.
And what is so different about this case where you don't know what you are? It seems like it shouldn't be that different, and yet the experience of that is so fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is Assassin's Con or if this is another game, but I know there's a game where... you're moving your pieces, but they're only allowed to move a certain way,
mm-hmm.
and the opponent knows which way they can move, so you'll attempt to move one of your pieces, and your opponent will say, no, you're not allowed to do that.
That is Deception from Stronghold Games, or Backwards Stratego, mm-hmm. I think, and you have a giant logic chart that you keep track of.
Oh my god.
I tried to move this two yeah. forward, and so he can't move two forward, so I'm going to cross that out. So he can't be this piece,
yeah.
and that is a brain melter if I've ever played one, but it's a pretty cool game. But yeah, it's got that same kind of... you don't know what your pieces are, right? That's got that feeling to it. And you have to figure it out.
Oh, that's actually a good transition to the next one, actually.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so the next one on the list is your workers don't rebel. So your workers will always do what you tell them to and behave in the way that you expect them to.
Well, I think we've established a counterexample here already with that. Like, you don't know what your pieces do, but your opponent does.
The other example that I can think of off the top of my head is Euphoria, where sometimes you'll put your workers on a spot and then it doesn't get to work.
right? It gets like bumped off or something.
You roll and if they're above a number, they're distressed that you're not paying them. I forget what the in-universe explanation is. Like, you didn't give them green cloud drugs and they go, they leave the spot and don't do the action, I believe. Or do they actually do it? They just go away.
I know in Stone Age, there's a die roll to decide whether or not the workers actually do the thing that's on that space.
Mm.
I think it's just a pass-fail. There's no, like, gradient.
In Stone Age, it's a numerical thing, right? Oh, so okay. you roll, and then you need a certain number of pips for each resource.
That's
so,
right.
If you need... if each resource takes 4 pips and you roll a 7, you're still only getting 1, even if you put multiple workers there.
Sure, if we add dice to the equation, there are plenty of games. Like, in Axis and Allies, my infantry rebel all the time. They never fire at the enemy. I don't know what's going on.
Oh, God. If there were a persistent track of that, like, with missed rolls being represented as increasing, like, disloyalty amongst the troops.
Your two-hit went up and down depending on history.
Oh, my God.
That would be all sorts of crazy.
That would be wild. But actively rebelling, like workers that actually leave you and go somewhere else. I think one of the key games, I can't remember which one it was, Keyflower, I think it was, where the meeples aren't owned by any particular player. Like, the colors of the meeples are varied, but no one player is one color of meeple. As soon as you use meeples to auction off for replacement hexes that you get added to your village. And as soon as someone wins one of those tiles to add to their village, they also get all of the workers that have been bid on for that hex. And those workers may be used as further auctions or may be used as worker placement to place onto their little village to activate the spaces that they've been building up in that village. In doing so, that's a sort of rebellion, I guess, kind of. It depends on, like, so much of this is like a kind of a thematic thing. Do you view these pawns as villagers or do you view them as just straight currency?
Yeah. And it's also, you know, it's similar. It's half that and half that your pieces are not yours.
Right. Yeah. They weren't yours to begin with, so I guess it's not really rebellion there. They've been mercenary the whole time.
And going back to the Euphoria example, I believe there's a situation where if your workers all, as a group, are smart enough or something like that, one of them leaves.
Mm.
Yeah.
They saw through the Matrix and they escape.
Yeah, that's another mechanic related to the die face that's showing on them. I don't remember exactly how it works, but the total on them is too high, then they get fed up with your dystopian society and go away. You have to roll up some less intelligent workers, I guess.
A more extreme version of this inversion would be that they leave this game and go to some other game.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Forget this, I'm going to Carcassonne.
I'm just going to go farm.
Life is so much easier in Carcassonne.
Alright, so this one I found really interesting as I was going through the list. Placing your workers is a good thing. You want to place your workers.
So this is a horrible stretch of workers, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Go.
Have any of you guys played Raxxon from Plaid Hat? I think that's the name
of it. I saw the marketing buzz around this for a long time.
They did a silly release thing with it where they sold it through a website. Like, you got like Gmail invites to buy the game, and then
you had to so whoever got it was able to send out invites to more people.
Okay.
Who were able to order.
But it's you can get it anywhere now, I think. So it's a little puzzle game where you are trying to flip over civilian cards that are. Well, they're either on the back, they're either zombies or carriers, or they're uninfected or whatever. And you're trying to quarantine all of the ones that are infected and get the ones that are uninfected out of this like shared deck that gets laid out on the board. But every time you take an action, you put a token on one of these bad consequences on this board. And then after every round, after everyone passes, all of the bad consequences that have a token on them happen to you. And then there's another action you can take to, like, wipe the board and reset the round, but that means that if there's zombies on the board, they're going to do bad stuff. So you're constantly trading back and forth between how many more of these bad tokens can I put out on the this board before we want to end the round and either suffer all these consequences or see what happens with the zombies in the crowd. And that feels a little bit like this. You're selecting which consequences you want to happen, and you know they're going to happen every round every turn until you end the round. So, yeah, it feels a little bit like a reverse worker placement game in that sense.
Yeah, so are we thinking about this as mixed bags? Because if that's the case, then Scoundrels of Skullport expansion for Waterdeep, introduces the corruption part of this. There are certain worker spaces in that expansion where you get significantly more resources than you would at any of the standard locations, but at the cost of taking a corruption token. Which is sort of a tragedy of the commons situation, where the more corruption in aggregate everybody has taken, the worse penalties there are, that each individual takes for each corruption token they have in their possession. So if I have one, and you have five, and Drew here has 10 or something, that will really drastically increase the cost of having just one corruption token. So it's... That I don't know if that's really quite what we're thinking of here, because you still get a heck of a lot of really good resources.
Yeah, I mean, usually that space is better because it also has something negative, right?
Right, yeah. And there's usually opportunities later in the game to absolve yourself of that corruption. And ideally, that's the way you play, is like you spend a whole bunch of time getting corruption, and about halfway through you pivot to really trying to clean up your reputation a little bit. But I can't think of... So a complete inversion of this would be placing a worker as a bad thing.
Which is such a strange, just overarching idea for a game.
Right.
Where it's like, if you're placing workers, but placing workers is a bad thing, then it is what is the good action, right?
Right. It almost seems like more of an art message a game. And sort of, I don't know, I could see themes where you don't want that person in that place, or it's not healthy for a person to be there. And as a result, say you'll lose that worker. Okay, here's a really grim theme that I've been thinking about. I have no idea how it would actually work because it's so sad. So I'm going to break this to you guys because I haven't talked to anybody about this. But recent events with the hurricane have got me thinking about some previous disasters that have come up historically and in recent history. So during the Japanese tsunami that destroyed the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, there were these elderly nuclear engineers and workers that volunteered. I don't know if they actually went through with this, but they volunteered to go in to Fukushima to repair some of the breaches that were there. I think this was before how significant the emergency became was really quite clear. But the fact that there were these volunteers who did that was such a like heroic and moving gesture to me. They just so willingly put themselves on the line. Like they just figured very pragmatically that we don't get that many years left. Let's go out like heroes.
Yeah, I remember reading an article about that, and they were like, you know, if you go in there, you're going to get cancer in 20 years, and we only have 20 years left to live versus a 30-year-old who's got 60 years left.
Right, kind of thing. And so you could theoretically take that theme and say that you are leading this expedition into Fukushima to repair the generator or the nuclear reactor, saving everybody, just horrendous potential disaster as a result. But it is a sad thing to have to place your worker there. And every time you do so, you do that with a sense of weight behind it that I think maybe would be a sufficient inversion of the typical place a worker is a good thing.
Yeah, certainly be very compelling. And let's use that and let's jump down the list a little bit. So the assumption that a game has to be fun or educational or at least not provoke sadness in the players.
Yeah, I gotta admit, I avoid breaking this assumption. I tend to make pretty light games. I try not to rock the boat a little bit too much, but sometimes themes come up that I think, wow, that would be really interesting to explore. Completely not commercially viable.
This definitely came up. I was working on a disaster management game, and I had the playtesters play it, and everybody was taking their own actions, and the person who was responsible for controlling the wildfires felt like they never had enough actions, and they didn't know where to go, and they didn't know what to do. And the person who was dealing with the hurricane felt like they didn't know how to prepare, and all they could do was wait. And I was like, okay, I've accurately represented the emotions in these disasters, and that is not a fun experience. So I shelved the game because of that.
I think there's an answer or a violation of this assumption that doesn't have to necessarily go into, you know, serious games or art games, and that's just sports or professional gaming.
Oh, yeah.
I would venture that for people with a lot of money and a lot of their career riding on the line, that the game that they're playing is not particularly fun. It's not educational. It probably doesn't make them sad either, but they're...
Good.
Well, when they lose.
Yeah.
But a game can be played for serious purposes and...
Big stakes.
Yeah, and not meet any of these criteria, I think.
Or a game could have started fun, and after playing the same game for 30 years of your life, it is no longer fun. I was thinking, and I have not played this game, but have any of you played The Troubled Life of Billy Kerr?
I am intimidated by that game, I gotta admit.
Mm. I see, yeah. So when I came up with that assumption, that was the game that I was thinking would have broken it. But having not played it personally, I can't speak to how it feels.
Yeah, I don't know that it's out just yet.
Not quite yet. I think it's coming out at Essen. There've been a few people that played it and reviewed it so far, but I think that's just mainly been content people, reviewers and such. The other game that came up, you occasionally see hear about games that are one-offs that are like shown at museums or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm kind of not considering those as examples just yet because we work so much in the commercial field of board game things. So I'm really strictly looking at published board games that have been intended as a product to sell. And so like the earliest one I can think of that is probably not the oldest, but just the earliest one I can think of is Freedom, the Underground Railroad, a cooperative game where you're abolitionists helping people through the Underground Railroad to escape the South and going north. And there's a very good Shut Up, Sit Down review of that one where they pointed out the thing I remember in particular was it took the distance that you feel when you move pawns or cubes around a board and put you in the position, but basically use that to the game's advantage to somewhat soften the sadness a little bit, but also to remind you of the position, the very privileged position that many abolitionists were in during that period where, yes, they opposed this very abusive system, but they did so from a position kind of high up where they wouldn't really necessarily themselves feel the consequences of it from the political sphere. People who were closer down to the ground, they faced more drastic risks from forces that were well outside of their control. And in the game, you are amongst those forces. Though you're all playing the good guys, and the game itself is acting as the bad guys, it's still a game that is profoundly difficult to bring to a table because it's just a very grim and serious subject that, in particular in the United States, is hard to talk about.
Yeah. On similar heavy themes, there's also, I know there's a game called Tomorrow, where I believe the entire premise of the game is that the world cannot sustain its population anymore, and you as a group have to figure out how to lower Earth's population by killing people off. And it's like, it's very, like, the board is very dark and very sterile looking, as far as I remember. And it definitely made waves when it came out, but I don't think it really is talked about much anymore because it was such... I want to say
5 years ago, maybe,
three to five, something like that, yeah.
I have seriously not heard about this.
Yeah, it's a... That was a pretty shocking theme, and wow. First time I saw that on the shelves, I was pretty surprised with it, because like a lot of... So, a lot of serious games with serious themes do kind of struggle with the... how much distance to put between the player and the subject matter, and that one... to me was just kind of like exploitation film level of like
a little too callous.
Yeah, it was really rough.
Yeah,
they didn't quite hit that nuclear war level of okay, you got change for 20 million people.
Yeah, actually no, that's about where it was. That's about
oh,
where
okay. It was. Okay, it was exactly
really where
it was.
Over the top. Like yeah. Make deals with people. Like, hey, can I kill 7 million of your people in order for you to like? Then you get to kill 7 million of my people on this thing.
Good lord.
Okay.
It just kind of. Yeah, I don't know.
Wow.
I think you can screw up that balance a little bit. For me, that one didn't hit right at all.
But yeah, definitely made a splash, but probably not a commercial success.
I don't know how well it did.
We're not really talking about it today, except in this
very,
context.
Very academic terms.
Yeah. All right, so let's go back to something a little bit lighter.
Sure, sure.
You have to sit at the table when you play the game.
Oh, geez. there's one version of this, The Great Del Moody. As you frequently getting up and switching seats in order to play, because your roles as the Great Del Moody, the Little Del Moody, I forget the terms of this. It's a very complex trick-taking game with lots of different roles and stuff, but seating order matters in that game quite a bit. As far as not sitting at a table, games where you don't sit at a table.
So there are plenty of games where there is no table at all.
True.
Right? So I'm thinking about games like, especially big party games, like Two Rooms and a Boom,
sure.
Where you're in two separate locations and you're going back and forth between those. And there are plenty of games that just don't need a table, right? Like, if you're playing Werewolf, you don't need a table, you need a ring of chairs. But there's also at least one game I know that makes you get up from the table, retrieve something that has been placed across the room, and come back to the table. And I can't remember what it's called.
There's kind of an underlying assumption here, maybe, which is that... you have to share physical space, or you have to share space with the other players of the game.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think if there's any really interesting ways of violating that.
You play in the same house, but you're just texting each other or something?
Well, like, you don't have any shared physical frame of reference for the rest of the game. I think there's a lot of, like, word games and kind of the games that you would play, like, in the backseat of a car on a long trip that kind of have that, where you don't need any representation of anything or any...
Yeah.
Actual apparatus to play it, so you could play it regardless of what kind of environment you're in, I guess.
I mean, taking this like really old school, you get your play by mail. Gamers from way yonder in ye old days of play by mail chess and war games and stuff. That they definitely did not share the same space with each other, but they're certainly playing games together.
And the interesting thing about that is, if you're playing a this is the only interesting thing about it. There are no other. but one of the interesting things about that is that when you're playing a war game or a game like that at a table with other players, you can see the way that they're interacting with the space and kind of get information from that. And you have access to the state of the board as they're interacting with it. And play by mail, you definitely don't. You completely lose the representation of the game space until the other person takes their turn. So
I'm hearing similar. I remember when video poker was starting up, and online poker was kind of building up as a response to the popularity of World Series of Poker and those big payouts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That old school poker players were very much lamenting the new crop of players that had only played online, and so they strictly ran by the numbers, didn't care about anyone bluffing or doing any of that, nor did they themselves play the social game or the psychological game when they actually went to a table. It was like, I think they were saying it's like playing against robots, just that happen to be humans, because they don't play those games. They strictly are about probabilities in the deck, and they do not deviate from those protocols. And I'm curious when the... So say we break this assumption, but then it overlaps with the assumption, where that liminal space is, how that changes gameplay between two players.
Well, and even today with apps, right? Mm. If you're playing, I don't know, Carcassonne with someone face-to-face versus playing over the internet, how much does that change the game just because you're not sitting at the table together?
Right. I frequently try to social game Carcassonne whenever I play it in person. It's hard to do that on the app.
All right. So this one, next one, is kind of a little unusual, but I think there have been a couple of games recently that break it, and that is that players will read the rules.
Do they ever?
Is that, yeah, I was going to say, that's an own assumption. They, one player will read the rules.
Not all of them.
Well, how about this one? The rules will be read before the game.
So we're making the assumption here is that...
Players will attempt to understand how the game works before they play it.
Right. Okay. And the most recent deviation from that is the Freedom and Freeze series of Fast Forward games, where you just open the box, read the first card that tells you what to do next, and you just keep on playing from there. Are there any other games that have been doing this lately?
This War of Mine tried to do it. It was a little bit less successful because it's a complicated game. Mm. So you can run into situations pretty early on that the walkthrough doesn't account for super well. And then you have to fish through the rest of the book. So you end up having to kind of read the rules anyway. But it did pretty well for the first few turns on that and ran kind of the same way. You follow open the box on the first page of the rule book is the setup and walkthrough for the first part of the first turn and keep going like that until you know how the game works.
There's also a game where you're not allowed to know the rules, but you take a card every time you don't follow the rules. So one person knows the rules.
What?
Have you not played this?
You've never played this?
What is this?
We've talked about this. This is a podcast throwback. We talked about this before, right?
You have to tell me.
It's Mal, right? That's the name of the card game? Yeah.
I think it's got multiple names, but that's
the... And then there's a print version that someone came out with. Pina Pirata, actually. Donald X. Vaccarino made a version of a game that's extremely, extremely similar to this. There's a print version, which we've got here called Cow. Quau.
Q-U-A-O.
It's got a cow on the front of it, so I assume it's Cow.
Cow.
But if you say Quau, you have to take a card.
Is that true?
Yes, it is now.
It is now, yeah.
It's that kind of game.
Yeah, so whenever someone wins a round, they assert a rule secretly in their head, and then whenever anyone breaks that rule, they penalize them by giving them another card. And the framework of the game is basically Uno or something similar. It grows more complicated as you play.
Oh, right.
And depending on who you're playing with, the rules that get thrown in can be, you know, goofy jokey stuff, or it can be like actually augmenting the way the game works. Like,
yeah, you can change
runs of cards if you want to, or something.
You
like
can
that.
Change the physical rules of the game, or you can say, you know, you have to have your left hand with three fingers out when you play a card, kind of thing.
You can have
actual game rules, and you can have meta rules.
Right.
Yeah. So that's an interesting example, and actually, when you start playing that game, no one is supposed to know any of the rules, I suppose. Uh-huh. So. Yeah, he definitely broke that there.
Where do deduction games fall into this? Because I'm thinking of something like Zendo, where the master has a rule in mind for how these plastic pyramids need to be arranged relative to each other. So the red has to be stacked onto the green, and the yellow pyramid has to be on its side, facing the stack of pyramids. Like, that's the rule that the master has secretly said. And it's up to the students to through the process of deduction, incrementally figure out what the arrangement is. And there are a number of deduction games that kind of have this, but it's still under the assumption that at least one player knows what they're doing.
Yeah, I think that falls into the same category, except that the goal of the game is to figure out the rules.
Yeah.
Versus some auxiliary way of winning the game once you know the rules.
Yeah.
So it definitely still fits the breaking of that assumption.
Yeah, but all the players still have to know how the communication works, right? In all of those games, there's like a signaling mechanism. You're like, this In Zendo, is it just yes or no?
Yes.
Okay.
No.
Is this a bit? We're doing a bit now?
So this kind of brings up a little bit of what I'm thinking of, too, is that you also have to know that you're playing the game.
Like, oh, boy.
You have to have entered the magic circle of the game, and that in itself is a rule that is, like, almost the first rule of any game.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a couple of rule games that really break that assumption. Well, I don't know that one is a game, but the first one I've thought of with that assumption is Concrud, where the entire idea is just to give someone else a card at a convention and not have them discover it until they get home. And then they find out that they've got Concord, and they take it to the next convention and pass it along.
Jeez. They could reject it. They could not agree to play the game and just
throw the card away.
Yeah.
But there's also an entire game based around that called Sneaky Cards.
Right, yeah.
Where there's just a whole bunch of different things that you're supposed to do and then give someone else the card, and now they're playing the game whether they knew it or not.
Button Shy has a similar thing. That the Sneaky Cards is a game right thing. Button Shy has I forget what the name of theirs is, but it's more specifically like game night stuff.
Yeah, it's player. You give this card to somebody when they do the thing that is very typical of a game, like the person who takes too long, or person who is like social gaming Carcassonne.
Our next assumption: when you are eliminated from a game, you are no longer playing.
Okay, so there's a really... I just want to throw this in here first. Mm. In Mario Kart 64, when you get eliminated, you turn into a bomb. It's the best thing that's ever happened.
Oh, wait, what?
In Mario Kart 64 in battle mode, when you lose all of your balloons, turn into an awful revenge bomb.
Oh.
And your goal, if you have the right attitude, your goal is to drive your bomb car at whoever did that and destroy them.
That is right.
You can't win anymore. Right? Which violates another interesting assumption, I think. So you cannot win, but you can still affect the outcome, and you may decide to affect it in a certain way.
Pure spite.
Out of pure spite. Like that mechanism a lot, and a way that got brought into a board game that I think is really interesting is in Mall of Horror / City of Horror, which are kind of... have either of you played those?
I think I played City of Horror.
They kind of build on the lifeboats kind of game. Everyone can sort of complete their goals and win, but everything is too scarce for everybody to be able to do it, so you're gonna be kind of voting people out of buildings and stuff.
I definitely played this. Yeah, I remember that now, yeah.
One of the things that can happen in that game is if you get eliminated, you get to decide where to place zombies, so if anyone was excessively mean to you, you're just like, alright, well, now because you are excessively mean, you won't win either, because zombies like you a lot. They like you a lot for the whole rest of the game, it turns out. Which is a kind of a balancing mechanism, which I think is really interesting. It's like a social balancing mechanism. You can't be too aggressive and mean to your fellow players, or you will suffer the majority of the zombies for the rest of the game. Hmm. So you have to be, like, deniable.
So it sounds like just more of a, like, elimination in this case. I feel like, not to be, like, pedantic about it, but it feels like elimination is a complete removal from game, like, by definition.
Ah.
So, and it seems like games that do this, where that change your position, change your team, for example, your alliance after a certain, like, game state condition, that is not an elimination, I don't think. I
mean, it's more than changing your alliance. It's you can no longer win. So you are completely out of the running of the game. I agree that I guess you're not eliminated because you're still interacting with the game state, but that's the assumption, right?
Sure.
So, and then in Who Should We Eat? There is a game where you are all on a desert island and you have to build a raft to get off, but there's never enough food for everybody to make it, and so when you get eaten by the other players, you become a ghost, and then the ghost haunts the players and makes it more difficult for them to win, but the ghosts can win.
The ghosts?
Yeah, extremely... I got involved in an extremely weird situation where literally I was the best player to eat, so as a human, when I was a human, we could not win. And so they ate me, and then because I was so valuable, then as a ghost, I could not win because they got enough resources. So I was like, I'm going to lose, and if you kill me, I'm going to lose.
Oh.
So it was a lose-lose on my part, but the humans did manage to win.
There's
that was very weird.
Pete Blander.
There's some expansions for Bang, I think, that reincorporate players who would have normally been, under my very pedantic definition, been eliminated, but instead they remain in the game as ghosts that periodically will come back and, like, shoot other players or something. I can't remember the exact details.
I think the ghost can still win, at least in the dice game one, I think they can.
I think the dice game is a little bit different than the card game, traditionally.
It's very interesting that it feels like 90% of these games, when you get eliminated, if you come back, you are a ghost.
Yeah.
Like, okay, it is a ghost. Not anything else. It's a ghost.
Or a zombie. I think it's easy to... It's an easy theme to parse, right? To explain why you've lost all your health points and yet you're still walking around influencing things. Usually to a limited extent, though. And I think ghost kind of, like, thematically usually makes sense of something that can have this ephemeral influence over the game state, but in itself is completely out of the quote-unquote running to win whenever the game happens to be. I don't think I've seen that in a... Seeing that mechanism in a game where the theme is much more realistic. Like, you don't see that in, like, I don't know, cooking competition games where...
You get eliminated from the competition and...
But you're still in there somehow. This is going to be the 1 30-second bit where I talk about The Genius. The Korean game show The Genius is a reality competition show. Everyone should watch it. But the first season's on YouTube. I'll skip this whole thing. But the very cool thing it does is, over the course of a very long game, one player will be up for elimination, but their right as that person is to choose an opponent from the rest of the group to go into a two-player game to decide who will actually be eliminated. In doing so, you are hesitant to really drastically betray people or really backstab during the course of the main game, because you don't want to be the one that's picked. Because you know for sure, either I am going to be the one who is chosen for elimination, or the one chosen to contest against the person who has been chosen for elimination. And that is an interesting, like, stopgap, right before the moment where you would become a ghost. But one interesting thing that The Genius does frequently is bring back eliminated contestants as judges or allies to the contestants that are still in play.
It's a classic reality show move to bring back the eliminated players and have them decide someone's fate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even Survivor started out that way, right? The last two is down to everybody else to choose. Is that how it works?
That is exactly the case. Once it's down to the last two, it's up to the rest to place their votes.
Alright, so our next assumption has definitely been broken a lot lately. I've been getting a lot of buzz about... All players are playing the same game. And you can think about this... I think the clearest way to think about this is just strong asymmetry, which we've talked about in the past.
Sure. Fast, root, all those.
Asymmetry is a pretty solid way of thinking about it. There's a game that pops into my head here that's, to me, actually fits this a little bit more strongly than those, because Vast and Root, all the players are still interacting with the same... set of pieces, the same kind of representation in the same... not in exactly the same way, but they have the same kind of metaphor, same understanding of what's happening, and they influence each other's win conditions, like, directly. There was a game that was at, not this past MPA, but the previous one, that was called Parkies, I think, which was a game where some people were playing a amusement park management sim. They're building an amusement park and putting down tiles that have rides and attractions and things. And some people were playing an amusement park enjoyment game where they move their people around a park to, like, engage with things and go on rides and get, you know, excitement points and whatever.
I heard about
that. And they don't affect each other's win conditions. So
it's just two simultaneous games happening.
It's two simultaneous games happening with the same stuff. But, I mean, they affect each other's win conditions because if the players that are the visitors go to your stuff, you get... money, I suppose, or whatever from that when they activate your, like, rides and tiles and things. And, you know, if you build attractions, the people that are visiting parks can go to those attractions. So there's an interface, but it's not the same thing as Vast or Root where, you know, you're competing for a win condition. They just intersect, which I think is really interesting.
It wasn't zero sum. So
yeah.
The builders and the visitors could both win.
There was always a winner in each part.
One visitor and one
builder. I believe one in each part, but it could have been multiple.
Wow.
And I think there was a game, I think it was called Panic on Wall Street, that does a very similar thing, where you have a group of investors and a group of bankers.
Yeah.
And so the investors are trying to invest in all the different banks and make the most money, and the bankers are trying to do something else. I don't know exactly what the goals are.
Yeah.
But literally one person of each group wins.
Yeah.
And they're playing completely different. Like, they're interacting with each other, buying and selling stuff.
Yeah,
each one individual in each group wins, which is weird.
each of the other games kind of, each of the other sets of players kind of formed an AI sort of almost for part of the other game, right? You're offering goods. You don't know if anyone's going to actually buy them or not because it's controlled by this other system where they don't care who among your group has the most money. They don't care about that at all. They're caring about their own stuff. Panic on Wall Street's a lot of fun. Loud and run around and knock people over. So
and it plays up to like 11, right? Yeah. Or something crazy.
It's solid stuff.
In a very limited sense, Blood Rage comes to mind because you can play the entire game with the intent to lose every battle, and the other person is sitting there just dominating the field and winning all the fights, and yet you have 40 more points than they do, and the other person is puzzled at the end because they thought they did everything right, they did everything that feels good, and yet your sea serpent is at the bottom of the lake and it scores you 24 points or something ridiculous.
You sent all your warriors to Valhalla.
Yep.
Yeah. That's actually an interesting case there, because sometimes you'll have a game where you'll get someone who just cries, you're not playing right.
Yes.
And in that case, it's those weird situations where sometimes the spirit of a game and the actual like optimal way to play the game are at odds with one another. But let's assume that's not the case in this hypothetical game, but let's just assume that there are two very optimal ways to play. It just so happens that they're wildly divergent from one another that I don't think is explicitly designed as a subversion of this assumption necessarily, but it is certainly in effect quite a bit asymmetrical. I would think if there were in Carcassonne a way to score points by never placing a meeple, never completing castles, never completing roads or something like that, or being rewarded for these incomplete features, that would be completely at odds to the gameplay that everyone else is playing.
I have the Wheel of Fortune version, and some of the players I play with only play the wheel. They never own any of the tiles they place. In fact, sometimes they help the player in last place to get more points, and then they just score 3 points every time the card comes up and the wheel moves around. And that's all that they do. And sometimes they come close to winning. I don't think they've ever actually won with just that strategy, though.
Might be about to show how bad I am at Euro optimization games, but Lowlands with two players feels a little bit like this to me. There's it's a semi-co-op aspect to it, where you're building a dike to block water from taking all of your sheep. And so one player can build that and get a lot of sheep, and the other player can just do fancy stuff with their board and ignore it completely. And they also won't suffer any penalty, because the penalty at the end is you would lose a bunch of sheep, and if you don't have them at all, then it doesn't matter. Huh. So you can just kind of be on completely divergent paths in the same game, I guess.
Huh. It's funny that I think we're stumbling into this idea of emergent divergence.
Yeah.
Which has a nice, elegant ring to it.
Yeah.
I think I'm gonna try and do a thing. Is it cool if I interject an assumption that I just kind of...
Go for it.
Up?
Yes.
You were talking about Blood Rage, and you were talking about the idea that people are playing a game wrong, right?
Oh, yeah.
So with regards to Blood Rage and a lot of other games, what do you think about the assumption that if a game contains fighting, you should?
That's interesting, because there are some games that explicitly have a pacifist route, and then there are other games that just have a system that you may not pick up on your first playthrough, but as you play the game, you realize that you could be incentivized to do all the things that don't involve fighting, and you would do just fine, or maybe even win with that. So I think I don't know how intentional that is from the designer's perspective. It probably is that they would say, well, I don't think you need to fight. I mean, you know, for instance, in Blood Rage, the victory condition for winning, the points you get for winning a fight are actually fairly low. It's like 3 to start with, but you can upgrade that. But compared to some of the other things that you can do, that's nothing. In the first round, you know, you're like, oh, I scored 9 points, and the other guy has like 25 points, and you don't really know what happened.
That's so many points.
Yes.
Can you think of a game where I can think of a half example, but I want to see if there's any better ones. A game where it contains a combat mechanic, but it is a penalty. It is bad to do it.
There's certainly a Scythe. I think it's frequently cited as a game where, yeah, there's combat. It's ostensibly a war game, but you are so reluctant to get into a battle because the costs are so explicitly high and the payoff is really limited.
And you see people like lose the first couple games they play of Scythe a lot because they're trying to beat people up all the time, and they lose all of their I forget what the name of the Goodwill or whatever it is.
But I think you can broaden that assumption to the way you presented it was, if a game is about fighting, you should fight. But I would extend that to, if a game is about X, you should X. So, if a game is about farming, you should farm. Is there a game where it's about farming and you fight all the time?
I've heard stories about people playing Agricola, and they didn't farm at all. They just built a giant house.
Right.
And they got a ton of points from their giant house. I don't know if they won or not, but...
I think
probably not.
You get a lot of these examples of point salad. You know,
sure.
Take that term or leave it, whatever you want to do, but when there are a number of ways that you could achieve the victory condition, to use a very abstract way of phrasing it, that you're going to get these ludonarrative dissonances.
Nope.
Are we not using that term?
Canceled.
Is that trademarked to ludology?
No, it's removed from the vernacular. It's a bad word.
All right, this episode won't air. Sorry. Going a little bit back, I was thinking of Twilight Imperium, where, you build war suns, and you want to use them. But if you use them, you lose, and the person you use them against also loses. And the guy who went the diplomacy route sneaks ahead and scores the last 2 points, and you wonder what happened.
I would say that it's not necessarily a subversion of what you're presenting, though, because in that game, I think it the promise on the box is as much fighting as there is diplomacy. With potentially high costs in going either route. I've certainly played most recently a very diplomatic and cautious game that got me close to victory, but definitely did not win me in the end. And so so much of this is kind of ties into marketing.
very much so.
Like if the box shows a bunch of farmers versus a bunch of fighters, I'm promised an experience that I would hope match what I'm actually going to get in the box. And I would certainly probably try to emulate whatever is on the box and do what it says. If it says it's about farming, I'm going to try to farm. But if I find that the optimal choice is, oddly enough, to just fight everybody I see and never pick up a seed or plant a tree, I'd be very confused.
Hey, listeners. We had such a good time talking about game assumptions that we recorded more than we could cram into one episode. So we're going to pause things here and conclude episode 46. The second half of our conversation will be out in a couple of weeks as episode 47. If you want to get in touch with us, find us on Twitter. I am at Apollo Continuum. Daniel is at Daniel Solis. Drew is at Even Weirder Move. And Matt is at Matt Haberfeld. To discuss this episode, please go to our guild on BoardGameGeek. Go to podcast.gdofnc.com, and that will redirect you to the guild. We love your feedback. We also have a group Twitter account that you can follow at GDofNC, which stands for Game Designers of North Carolina. Stay tuned for a few bits of news coming right up, and then that'll do it for this episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Okay, well, let's go into some Game Designers of North Carolina news. Matt, why don't you go ahead and start with Dark Side of the Mine?
Absolutely. Dark Side of the Mine will be on Kickstarter in November, we are hoping. You know how it goes. Where the target date is November, we are on target until we are not on target.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, I'm working with the people at Tabletopia to make the game available for free for the entire duration of the Kickstarter, and then it will become a premium game for people who have a Tabletopia subscription. So we might have a future podcast about putting your game on an electronic medium.
Oh, there we go. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Daniel.
I have a demo video on YouTube for Flying Taxi that is in anticipation of pitch meetings that I'll be having at PAX Unplugged and at Board Game Geek Con.
All right, and we'll have the link to that in the show notes. Two other pieces of news. Group member Josh Mills has a new game, Big Easy Busking. Which is coming from Weird Giraffe Games. I don't know exactly when, but I believe the goal is early 2019. And then his other game, American Steel, which is a co-design with Nat Levan, and it won the Ion Award back in March. That has been signed, although we cannot reveal the publisher yet.
Mystery!
Yeah, look for the actual announcement on a future episode. He basically said, yep, it's fine, you can tell people, but not by who. So,
Okay. Gotta be mysterious, don't you, Josh?